Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
As a physician for some 27 years or so, Dr. Claggett, how are you?
I'm fine, Derek. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. You know, we're praying for you and with you. And I'm just so glad that you are in the business of saving people's lives, and but it's scary. You know, it's scary, but some necessary work. What are we seeing? We're looking at the numbers here in Georgia. I just heard our newsroom say there are 7,314 confirmed positive COVID-19 folks who've been tested. 229 has died. I think that was as of noon. That number keeps going up. What's the state of this disease or this virus, Dr. Claggett, from where you sit?
So as predicted, those numbers continue to climb. That's not a surprise to us. We knew that the numbers would climb. What we're looking to see is that we peak and then begin to come down. So I think in Georgia, they're expecting our peak to be within the next 1 to 2 weeks. New York is this week. So as predicted, our numbers are going up. There are some promising signs, though.
Give us the good stuff first.
Good stuff. Let's start with the good stuff. On April 4th, we had about 1,165 deaths. I'm sorry, we had 1,330 deaths. And then yesterday, we saw a decline in the number of deaths. So we saw a decline.
Now, that's nationwide.
So that tells us.
That'd be more than 1,000 nationwide. You must mean 10,000. How many nationwide?
Yeah. Okay. it's in a day. I'm sorry, per day.
Oh, a day. I was going to say, because, we got 220-something right here in Georgia. So 1,000, we're averaging 1,000. How many a day?
So on the 4th of April, we hit our peak at that time, or record, which was 1,330 deaths on April 4th across the country.
And that April 4th was Saturday. Was it Saturday or Sunday? Because the day
Saturday.
Is what? The day is
that
the 6th, so that was Saturday. April 4th was Saturday. So Saturday,
Yeah, and then Sunday, we dropped that number down to 1,165, so we saw a reduction in the number of daily deaths. Now, that's just one blip, right? What I'm interested to see is what happens today. We'll see our numbers after today. What I'd like to see is a continued decline in the number of deaths. And that would be a sign that we're moving in the right direction. But again, that's just one data point. We could see that number go back up. The bulk of those numbers are coming from New York. So I think we're getting all of our leads from New York. If we see, we can tell what's going to happen in the country by what happens in New York to some degree, because they have been hit the hardest with it.
Yeah. You know, now becomes the issue of people of asking the obvious question, right, about racial disparity. And we are seeing some numbers suggest, for whatever reason, this disease, predictably, or this virus, in terms of the mortality rate, that black people are checking out a little bit faster than others. Is that what you're seeing in your data set as well?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit premature just yet to draw any accurate conclusions. But from what we are seeing, we see that, as expected, African Americans seem to be carrying a bulk of a disproportionate number of infections and deaths relative to others. Now, that data is not complete, so I caution everybody not to run with that. And let me tell you why. In all likelihood, the concentration of testing is likely in the urban centers where we concentrate the highest. So it will be interesting as time passes. I think what your point is that we should be very cognizant of is, are there any racial disparities between who gets this infection and how they die? Because we know if other diseases such as heart disease and lung disease and diabetes and hypertension pay true to the numbers, we would expect that our community may suffer a more negative impact on this disease. Yeah. But it's premature at this point. I think it's hard to draw any real concrete conclusions.
Male, female, is that, y'all been able to look at that in terms of just separating these classes? Who's getting this the most?
That's data that's been out for a while, since China and now Italy, Spain, and throughout the country. There's a disproportionate number of males that are affected with the disease relative to females. So we know that that is the case. Remember, we talked about some increasing prognosticators for getting the disease and having a worse outcome. Being male was one of those. Having comorbidities, the data showed 2.7 comorbidities were
bad. And tell comorbidity, now you're going back into your doctor talk. Comorbidity just simply means you have some
underlying medical conditions, whether that's hypertension, diabetes, lung disease, asthma, COPD, emphysema, or heart disease. So those are all factors. One thing I do want to talk with you about is what's changed over the last week, or what are we treating patients with, if anything, and what are the vaccines? Where are we with the vaccines? Because there's been some discussion about anecdotal treatment that we're doing as well as vaccines.
Look, we got to take a quick break. I want you to come back. I want our people to go and get them a pen, paper, get them a drink of water so they can receive this information. Got to take a quick break. We'll come back, Doc. Let's talk about vaccines. Let's talk about drug combination. They're now saying a drug that was originally intended to treat HIV patients is showing some promise. Bring us up to speed on any of that when we come back. Again, our special guest on the studio line, he's kind of been our COVID-19 expert, is Dr. Von Claggett, a physician for more than 27, 28 years. And he's in the hospital working with patients every day. And we appreciate him for sharing this information with us. Don't go into places. Too Much Truth with Derek Bozeman on News and Talk 1380 WAOK. Vaccination, drug combinations, medical breakthroughs of what has been happening in the last few weeks, last week or so, or last few days, that is promising, that holds some promise for us being able to say we have this thing under control medically.
So, as we've consistently said over the last several weeks, there currently is no effective treatment, cure, or vaccination for SARS-CoV-2. What you are seeing are a number of controlled, randomized, double-blinded studies where they're looking at a variety of cocktails. The one you hear the most of is Plaquenil, which you know as hydroxychloroquine, and azithromycin. That's one that a lot of folks are talking about right now. There are some studies out there right now that they're looking at that. We have not seen any positive results. So to our experience up to this point, the use of hydroxychloroquine or azithromycin in combination has not been shown to be effective. We'll see what the ultimate data shows, but it's not been shown to be effective. The next medicine, which you mentioned briefly, was antiretrovirals, HIV medicine called Calitro, which is really a combination of two medicines. That they looked at as well, and they looked. They actually did a study on that in the New England Journal of Medicine. They released that on March 18th, and that showed no effect whatsoever on SARS-CoV-2. So that is not effective at all. The last major last medication and trials that we're looking at, and there'll be others that we'll look at, but the one we're really optimistic about is a medicine called Remdesivir. And Remdesivir is an antiviral medicine. It's what we call a nucleotide analog, and what that really means in layman terms is that RNA and DNA are made up of what we call nucleotides. And this is an analog to one of those nucleotides. And we found Remdesivir to be very effective against Ebola, and then they tried it on MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, as well as SARS-CoV-1, we'll call it, the original SARS-CoV, and it showed some promising results. So we are in a large controlled randomized trial right now across the country using Remdesivir. I think it's in a phase 3 trial at this point. So we'll see if that actually has any real effect. That, of all the medicine we're using, we think might have some benefit, but we're not sure just yet. So right now, as it stands, there remains no treatment. Anything that anybody is doing is anecdotal, meaning that they're trying it. It has no proven benefit. And some of these medicines have side effects, the hydroxychloroquine being the one that is promoted the most by a number of individuals, has side effects. And some of those side effects include irregular heart rhythms, which can cause sudden cardiac death, some problems with your vision in the eyes, and there are some problems with the liver. So we are very careful not to place patients on those medications unless patients are informed, they know the risk, the benefit, and we think that we absolutely should try it because the patient has deteriorated to a point where there may be no other choices. But it is
so.
Not
what are those? Yeah, let's just take hydroxychloroquine. What is it generally used for? What would it be an acceptable treatment for?
Yeah, so that's a
good
question.
Who gets that?
We generally use hydroxychloroquine. Some people will know it as Plaquenil out there in your listening audience. We use it for a number of autoimmune diseases, most notably lupus. So people who have lupus often are on Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine. It's an immunosuppressant, so it does suppress the immune system, which in and of itself can be problematic in certain people.
Yeah, I think why would you want to suppress the immune system and a person that's fighting a virus?
So that's a very good question, Derek. Remember that the problem that people have when they get infected with a virus or any infection, and in this particular case, is that you get an immune response where your body's immune system gets revved up. And because it gets revved up, it causes damage to end organs, including the lungs, the kidneys, the liver, liver, blood pressure. So we call that a cytokine storm. Cytokines are substances within the body that allow our immune system to communicate with each other. So each of the different cells that we have within our body, our immune cells, they have to communicate with each other to recruit them to certain areas, to cause them to reproduce or proliferate is what we call that.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to send that message out, they send it out through a message called a cytokine. And that is what stimulates the immune system to get ramped up, and there are side effects to the immune system being ramped up. So in some cases, in patients who have what we call a cytokine storm, we give them medicines to try to blunt that immune response.
Down.
We believe that Plaquenil likely has some of that effect. We also know that Plaquenil is in of itself, or hydroxychloroquine, is an antiviral. It affects the ability of the virus to reproduce by blocking the replication of the RNA.
All right. Now, I know I was offered like a pneumonia vaccination. If pneumonia is one of the side effects of this, what is a pneumonia vaccination, and why isn't that like standardly given?
So the most common pneumonia vaccination, I presume you're speaking of, is a pneumococcal vaccine, right? Now, pneumonia can come in a lot of different forms. We can have viral pneumonias. We could have bacterial pneumonias. The pneumonias that we vaccinate people against, which I assume you're referring to, is a bacterial infection. That is different than this viral infection that we get.
Okay.
Now, it's certainly possible you could get a viral pneumonia from SARS-CoV-2 and then get a super infection on top of that, and that being a number of bacteria, including pneumococcal pneumonia.
I just know it was offered to me. I didn't know what it was. And so I was like, why do I need it?
So I would recommend that there are certain groups that we recommend should have pneumococcal vaccines. You'll have to check with your doctor out there in the audience. Check with your doctor to see if you fall within that category. Generally, it includes our older patients above 65. And patients who are immunocompromised, who have problems with their spleen, or they have their spleen removed, and so forth. The general public generally, the most people do not get a pneumococcal vaccine.
So give us, just remind us, Dr. Claggett, when do we know this is gone? When do we know? Is it just a vaccination and then all 400 million people need to get vaccinated? Is it when our own immune systems have kicked in and they have developed a response to it, that our bodies have antibodies to fight it when we come back again? What is the penultimate way of arresting this SARS-CoV-2? What from the medical standpoint is, you all know, we can move on to the next thing because this one now is under control. Can you answer that? We got to take a quick break. On the other side of the break,
good deal.
When will we know that we are beyond this and we can be waiting on whatever the next thing gonna be coming around the curve?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Again, our special guest is Dr. Von Claggett. If you got any questions, because Doc got to get back to seeing patients, call us up now at 404-892-2703. If you got any questions about this disease, this virus, how it is transmitted, how it will be arrested, what do you need to do if you suspect you may have it? You showing symptoms of it? What do you need to do? We have the expert here to tell you that. We got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more with Dr. Von Claggett right here on News and Talk 1380 WAOK. And maybe a couple times during the week, we try to give you as much information as to trends, as to tracking, as to what's on the horizon. Our special guest is Dr. Von Claggett. Dr. Claggett, obviously, we keep talking about bending the curve, but at what point will we know we out of the curve? And what is this going to require as a response? Is it going to just magically disappear? Tell us the sequencing of what will happen. Will everybody need to get vaccinated against it? How does a virus like this disappears out of the general public, or is diminished to the level that the general public is not a health concern for all of us?
So the ultimate desire is that we eradicate the virus, right? That we get rid of the virus altogether. And the most optimistic answer to that would be that we can actually treat the virus and eventually through treatment and immunization, either naturally or through vaccine, that the virus will then disappear. That is the ultimate desire. That's unlikely to happen. We're likely to just knock the virus down to a tolerable level where we're able to treat it on an ongoing basis. Okay? So what are the goals that we're looking for immediately? So we're looking for containment and mitigation. So we're looking to knock the virus down to an acceptable level where the transmission is reduced. We know that the transmission is reduced if we're able to test a large number of people and we're able to see that the new incidence of infections has dropped consistently. Okay? The ultimate endpoint being that we see the number of people dying from the disease actually drops. So some of the things we're doing right now to help in that process is social distancing, shelter in place, and the whole idea with that is to flatten the curve. And what they mean by flatten the curve is that they reduce the incidence of new infections to a point where we do not overwhelm the healthcare system, and we allow people over time to get over the virus, and also some will, or those who come in contact with it, will develop a natural immunity to the infection. As with any infection, you get it, and you will, if you survive it, you will develop some immunity to it. Now, in addition to that, we like to augment that process by being able to treat the infection if we can. That's where we're working on a number of medications, such as remdesivir, and a host of other things that we're trying to treat people who get infected so that they overcome the infection over time. And then the last major component to it is to build up an immunity to that. And that will either be through what we call a herd immunity, where a large number of people become infected over time, they get over it and they build up an immunity, or we vaccinate people and build up their immune system to that particular allergen, infection, so that when they become exposed to that infection, they have an immunity. So let's talk about vaccines a little bit. Vaccines. We've been vaccinating people against infections for a very long time. So what we are now working on is really coming up with a vaccine that is effective against this virus. Now, one thing to keep in mind, the way that we vaccinate people is generally by introducing them.
Yeah, give them part of it.
Part of it. We call that part of it an antigen. So we give them an antigen. In this particular case with SARS-CoV-2, we know the structure of this virus. It consists of a membrane, an envelope, and a spike protein, which everybody knows about now, the S protein. We believe it's the S protein that attaches to the receptor on the host cell, our cells, and that is the process by which it enters the cell. So what they are working on now is a variety of vaccines that affect the virus in different ways. What likely is going to happen is they will introduce a piece of the virus. We'll call it the spike protein, and if that's what they choose, they can use a number of things. They'll introduce that to the immune system of a person. We know the S protein in and of itself, by itself, is not problematic at all, right? If you get a little piece of it, you need the whole components to actually do that.
Right.
So we introduce that into the immune system, and once your body sees it, your immune system then recognizes it as being foreign, and it begins to create an immune response, recruit other immune cells to that area to fight off that infection. And the immune system is very powerful in that it remembers every antigen or foreign body it comes in contact with. So that next time you see that infection, it already has an immune system that's ready. So we can actually trick the immune system by giving it a piece of the virus or bacteria or antigen, whichever we choose. We give it to somebody. We trick the immune system into thinking that it's got the infection. It builds up an immune response and a memory so that next time you see that infection, that virus, your immune system is now ready to go and fight that infection and contain it. So that's really the premise in a very basic way of how vaccines work. People say, well, if you get a vaccine, you'll get the infection. No, you will not get the infection. Now, there are rare cases where we actually use live viruses. But in this particular case, we would not use a live virus. I doubt it. We'll use either a re-engineered part of the virus or part of the structure of the virus, and we'll introduce that. You will not get infected from the virus, from the vaccine. That just is not possible.
All right. What other virus like this have we built up a natural immunity against to suggest to us that this is going to be an effective way for the body to respond to it? What are some of those other viruses?
So there's a host of viruses that we come in contact with on a regular basis, from adenovirus to rhinovirus to other coronaviruses. We're constantly in contact with them. But most of them will cause a self-limiting infection, and you'll get over it. The flu is a great example. Not everybody gets the flu shot. They sometimes will get the flu. If they get the flu, they build up an immunity to the flu, and they're unlikely to get that flu again during that season. The reason we continuously vaccinate people is because the viruses mutate over time. They are just as smart as we are, if not smarter sometimes, and they mutate so that they can fight the immune system and trick the immune system into not recognizing it. And that's why we have to vaccinate people over and over again. But we vaccinate people a lot to build up immunities. We do it with hepatitis, right? Hepatitis A, if you travel.
Right.
Hepatitis B, we do that.
Right.
HPV, now that we know that HPV, human papillomavirus, is associated with cervical cancer, which we've known for a while, and now we know it's associated with squamous cell cancer. We now vaccinate children against HPV.
Right.
So this is
all right, Doc, do this. We got to take another quick break when we come back, because I think what you're saying is critically important. Come back, we'll let you wrap it up for us and tell us what we need to keep doing, and you can finish your thought on this particular issue. Don't go into place. Our special guest, Dr. Von Klagen. If you got questions, he got answers. 404-892-2703. We'll be back in a moment. It's Too Much Truth with Derek Bozeman on News and Talk 1380 WAOK.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
And so basically, Doc, when I'm taking those vaccinations or taking that medication, I am basically, trying to make sure that as I visit these places, I'm already have a natural built up response to these viruses, disease, or whatever. It's basically
That's
that
correct.
Concept.
That's it. We're just All exposing right. you to the antigen so that when you actually do see it, your immune system is ready to fight it.
Okay. Emergency rooms are just crowded now. I mean, the average, give us some sense, the average hospital, let's talk about maybe Grady, if you know, it's probably the largest hospital and got to be one of the largest in Georgia to see more patients than anybody, perhaps. It's emergency room couldn't take. They go on diversion if they get more than 40, 50 people at one time. What is the capacity of a general emergency room in a hospital of that size? And how many, we're talking in Georgia alone, 7,000 something people, 229 deaths. We don't know if all of those made it to the emergency room. But what percentage of people who come in sick with some COVID-19 positive confirmatory test is going to end up in the emergency room or ICU? I mean, how are these hospitals able to deal with it?
So, every hospital is different with its capacity based upon the size of the hospital, the number of ED beds. But let's speak in generalities. What we know from the last several months of looking at COVID-19 is that of the people who get infected with COVID-19, 80%, 8 out of 10,
will
get the infection.
Question for the doctor.
They'll feel bad, and they'll get over it. 20%.
Okay, yeah, we're not even dealing with them. We know that 80% off the rip, you're going to be fine. Your body going to respond. Let's talk about capacity of, because everybody's talking about from New York on down, we do not have the capacity. How many people, if 200 people came down and got sick with this one time, is there a single hospital that can, an emergency room, that can handle that many patients?
Yeah, so just do the math on it. If 20% of the people get the infection end up hospitalized, okay?
All right.
And you said 200. So we're looking at 40 people that would need to be admitted. So our biggest concern is that we have a spike in cases in a very short period of time, of which 20% of those people who get infected will need to be hospitalized. Therein lies the overwhelming of the system when it all occurs at once. Hence the reason we say we want to flatten the curve.
All right. Now, if you got 200 a week, then that's one thing, but 200 a day, no hospital has the capacity,
or 20,000 a day. In a city of in Atlanta, metro area Atlanta, where you have 6 million people,
right.
If a quarter of those people get infected, or a third of those people get infected, that's what, 2 million people that get infected in a short period of time. Of 2 million people, if 20% of them need to be hospitalized, that would overwhelm the system in Atlanta. We don't have the capacity. So therein lies our biggest concern, is that people will get infected and become acutely ill at the same time.
Right. I'm just trying to see, where are we at now in that scheme? Are that capacity still available at hospitals or what?
Well, we have done some things in the healthcare system across the country and certainly in Atlanta that has helped to alleviate that issue. One of the things we've done is that we've done social distancing and shelter in place, which reduces the number of people get infected. Specifically with the hospital, we have eliminated elective procedures and elective surgeries. So by eliminating elective procedures and elective surgeries, we've now opened up a number of beds in a hospital that normally would be filled by those people. So we don't know.
I mean, but here's the thing. Only thing I'm asking, as a doctor, you know, how many beds are available? I don't think the general public, I have no idea how many beds would be available at Grady, at Emory, Crawford Long, any of them.
So I don't know the bed count at Grady. At Emory Midtown, for example, we have about 500 beds there total.
That's right? Total for the entire hospital.
For the entire hospital. For a city.
Yeah, so and what percentage of that would be like emergency room kind of, you know,
admission?
I mean, critical care, because these people come in critical.
So let's you're asking me a question I don't have the answer to, I guess, is the reason.
Okay,
why
all right,
I'm
cool, that's
that.
Fine.
Is that I don't know the capacity of how many beds we have in the city and how many ICU beds we have in the city. What I can tell you is that the capacity is significantly under the availability of those beds, particularly those ICU beds, which account for generally less than 10% of the beds of the hospital.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for. What is it said? Now, if you got 500 in your standard ICU, intensive care, this is people who need 24-hour monitoring, ventilators, doctors on call, sitting there. If your capacity is 500 and you only have 50 of those type beds at, Crawford Long, for instance, that just tells you that system can be overwhelmed very quickly.
Very quickly. And then that doesn't take into account that those are just ICU beds. Then we have to talk about the equipment for ICUs, such as ventilators,
which we may not have
ventilators for every single room.
Yeah, right. And the fact of the matter is, notwithstanding this, people are still sick. People are still having heart attacks. People are still having babies. People are still, the regular healthcare needs still have to be met along with this. You know,
absolutely.
We can't tell the person, stop having a heart attack. We don't have a place for you.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think we got somebody on the phone.
You can understand
go ahead.
The ability to overwhelm the capacity. In the country, we have 960,000 hospital beds, roughly, of which about 10% of those are ICUs. So we're talking about under 1 million hospital beds for a population of 330 million people.
Okay, gotcha.
The math just doesn't work.
Let's see. Let's go to our phone. Let's see who do we have on the phone. We got at least try to get him in real quick so we can let you go. Go ahead.
Vanessa.
Okay, go ahead, Vanessa.
Okay. My question is, it seems to me that there's a higher concentration in places like Texas, New York, Fulton County, and then you got Midwestern places where I know its population is part of it, but why is that?
So that's a great question. Why are certain parts of the country more problematic than others as it relates to the incidence of disease? And I think she answered her question very well,
yeah.
Which is really density. We're talking about the density of population and those places mm-hmm. where we have close proximity of individuals with each other, riding on the subway, riding on public transportation, working together. We're going to have higher incidence. So in our large cities, we're going to see that. But no place is protected, so every place will ultimately be exposed.
Right. And that's why, again, social distancing is just like, you know, if you're single, then that's one person touching that door every time. If there are 10 folks in your household, that's 10 people touching that door. And then you got to account for where all of those people have been. And so, you know, it's just one of those phenomena. Dr. Claggett, look, man, thank you for all you do. Appreciate your service. We appreciate the service of all of the personnel who find themselves in medical facilities, from the doctors to the nurses to the technicians to the janitors who clean up, having gone in and out of hospital recently. I just have a newfound respect for it. Having gone 51 years without ever having to walk into a hospital room, and then last couple of years, I failed through a glass table and a bunch of other stuff. It is just, I appreciate y'all. I know that it is not, it's not easy, because you got to think about your own children, your own family, at the same time, taking all the necessary precautions to preserve life on the front end, to comfort those who may find themselves in the last part of the stages of this disease who are not coming back as a result of it, and to continue to remind us to do everything we can so we don't end up in front of you. And so thank you, man, for one, providing information, being readily available to share with us the latest trends, what's happening. We don't take it for granted at WALK. We appreciate you. All right.
Yeah, you're welcome. Just one last note to the general public. This is we are still in the midst of this. You have not gotten through it. I know it's getting long and the days are getting hot and the days are getting long. Continue to social distance. Continue to wash your hands. Avoid your face. And just be careful, because you do not want to end up in the hospital, and you certainly don't want to be a statistic. So just be patient and let's get through this.
All right. Thank you, Doc.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.